Welcome to Zero Point Radio. This is Christopher Holmes, mystic scientist, adventurer. And we're back for another two-hour broadcast. And once again, our focus today is on the teachings of H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. And I'll introduce my co-host, and we have two guests on today, and we're going to be talking about the Theosophical Conference coming up in Petaluma in California on later in August. And we'll be talking about that today and about the work of Madame Blavatsky. I work under the name of Zero Point, and the term Zero Point, although it's become known in modern physics because of the study of quantum theory and people investigating the zero-point fields, the term actually goes back to 1888 and was used by Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, where she explains ancient metaphysical principles. And she explains the idea of zero points as being... It's as if any living being or any living cosmos has a zero-point center. And differentiation of a living being occurs from a point source. So in the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky says there's an archaic manuscript before the author. And the first page is a circle against a dull background. And the second page is a circle with a point in the center. And she says that point represents the first point of differentiation. And she predicted in 1888 that our universe emerged from a zero-point center. Okay, and then a century later, modern scientists have now arrived at the same idea, that indeed our universe emerged from a singularity condition in science, which is judged to be 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So really, this is quite an astonishing prediction based on Blavatsky's archaic teachings. But Blavatsky applies this concept not only to the universe, but to any living being has a zero-point center. Okay, now, Blavatsky's work, it's amazing how much it's been ignored in modern times. Throughout the educational system, philosophy, religion, psychology, it's like The Secret Doctrine has remained secret for the past century. And yet, in light of the newest developments in modern physics, especially as regards to holographic physics, and new concepts about the information processing of black holes put a whole new light on certain aspects of Blavatsky's archaic teachings about zero-point centers and how the laws of the physics operate. Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine says that the universe is founded on seven invisible points. So in a way, these are zero points. Okay, now... I'm just going to quote a quote. I'm interested in the issues of creation versus evolution, and Blavatsky's teaching, of course, belies that simplistic dichotomy. But I have a quote here from The Key to Theosophy. An inquirer asks Blavatsky, "Do you believe in God?" Blavatsky answers, that depends what you mean by the term. The inquirer says, "I mean the God of the Christians, the Father of Jesus and the Creator, the biblical God of Moses, in short." And Blavatsky answers, "In such a God we do not believe. We reject the idea of a personal or an extra-cosmic and anthropomorphic God who is but the giant shadow of man and not of man at his best either. The God of theology, we say, and prove it, is a bundle of contradictions and a logical impossibility. Therefore, we will have nothing to do with him," Blavatsky says. And then she goes on, and in The Secret Doctrine, she explains, "The Secret Doctrine admits a logos, or a collective creator of the universe, a demiurgos, in the sense implied when one speaks of an architect as a creator of an edifice. Whereas that architect has never touched one stone of it, but while furnishing the plan, left all the manual labor to the masons. In our case, the plan was furnished by the ideation of the universe, and the constructive labor was left to the host of intelligence, powers, and forces. But that demiurgos is no personal deity, an imperfect extra-cosmic god, but only the aggregate of the Dhyan Chohan and the other forces. The point of this is that Blavatsky has a concept of God not as this anthropomorphic man who sits up in heaven and gives commands and creates everything in final form, but rather her concept of the deity is that the deity sets the creation process into motion, but then that creative process is carried out by divine intelligences and spiritual intelligences. And she explains that these higher dimensional spiritual and divine intelligences, their influences are operative from a zero-point level. At one point, Blavatsky says, deity is in every point of the universe. Okay, so that idea of that point is like the zero point. If we want to experience the deity, it's like we have to go down, down, down into the substratum of existence, and God is within every point at a lower level. Okay, so anyway, zero points, she says deity is in every point of the universe, the concept is that we similarly have such a zero-point center, and as does any living cosmos. Okay, I'd like to move on, and I would advise people, I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca. I'm afraid I haven't been working at my website too much lately, but I have a lot of material up there, so I hope you visit my website. And I'll introduce the co-host, James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. James, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Chris?
Okay. I was just watching a movie on the over the internet by Dr. Deagle, which is a little bit shocking. Another one of these people who are kind of exposing all that's happening in our society in this time. I just kind of realized the craziness of what's happened in our society. So feeling a little discouraged by realizing that. A good show on prior to my show with John Coolis there from the Netherlands. John, I appreciate your work and follow your work. A lot of people out there trying to bring the truth forth in these mad days that we're in. Okay, so any thoughts, Jim?
A couple of things. One, when you talked it going down to the substratum of existence and the lower, in a way it's lower, but it's also higher. Like, you know, I mean, really, really, lower and higher don't really pertain because it's beyond the dimensionality of physical reality. So, like, I mean, in a way, like, it is lower in the sense that it's smaller and smaller and infinitesimal, but it's also like it's higher in the sense that it's more intelligent, more informed. Like the dimensions that inform the physical dimension are beyond the zero point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Blavatsky says that at one point. She says external location has no meaning. It's only an illusion, this idea of space and separation. That's only an illusion. Really, a space-time complex is created out of a point. So as you say, it isn't really lower or higher. It's within.
Yeah.
Creation dynamics, things work from within, without, from zero points. Hence the name of my book series, Within, Without, from Zero Points.
Yeah, I guess from reading your work over the last several years and being introduced to Madame Blavatsky's thought on these things, just about space and trying to think in kind of different ways about these things, I really find that quite fascinating that... she has a very radically different way of kind of, you know, having us try to entertain our thoughts, but it's difficult to wrap our heads around this. Even if, like, you know, we were physicists, it would be difficult, but it's just difficult because it's so counterintuitive and it's so against everything that we've been taught, about the nature of reality. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was that you mentioned earlier about the seven invisible points?
Yeah.
Okay, now, would you say that, I was just wondering, like, would you say that what she's referring to is, like, these seven invisible points are, like, the seven 0 points that link the seven levels of creation of the hierarchy of the cosmos or the dimensions of consciousness in the cosmos? Or what's your interpretation of that? Like, are those, like, what I'm getting at is, like, compared to, like, in Gurdjieff's teaching, you have the ray of creation where you have a dissension of world orders out of the absolute, and each world order is increasingly denser and vibrating at a lower frequency, and so you have more material in is a way of thinking of it, I guess, so that you have like a dissension from the absolute to our physical dimension, and we have these different planes of consciousness and reality. Would you say like that she's saying like the 0 points link each of these rungs in the ladder of creation, is that a way of thinking of it?
Well, that's an aspect of it, but it's also, see, Blavatsky talks first of the primary level of creation, which is in spirit and light, which is mm-hmm. like the creation of the heaven worlds, of the divine intelligences. Okay, but then, and so those are sevenfold, seven Elohim, seven Dayan Chohan, mm-hmm. seven spiritual beings, seven rays, okay? But when their intelligence is conducted by what she calls Fohat.
Right.
Fohat is this kind of cosmic electricity which manifests energetically the intelligence of these seven Elohim. So there's a spiritual plane above, and then the Fohat are in soul the seven planes of existence below. So in the stanzas of Zen, it says seven inside, seven outside. So there's seven levels of spiritual world, there's seven levels of material creation. Both are sevenfold, and this Fohat, which connects spirit to matter, runs circular errands. And she says of Fohat is one, but then Fohat is sevenfold.
Okay.
So there's a 1 0 point, but then that differentiates into a sevenfold dynamic of 0 points. It's as if, imagine, like, I would say we have a 0 point center within the heart center, which is the central chakra within our system.
Right.
But then each chakra has a 0 point center.
Further to differentiate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's an analogy, is the one and the seven. So for Blavatsky, yeah, everything is sevenfold. Seven spiritual intelligences.
Right.
Connected through seven Fohats and seven realms of material creation.
Just a thought that, you know, when you're talking about the Fohat, do you think that's akin in, like, in Beelzebub's tales when Gurdjieff talks about I think it's the omnipresent Onidok or
Okidanok. It's like the etheric
substance. Yeah, that's interesting. Because when you were saying that, I thought, gee, that sounds a lot like, you know, what Gurdjieff.
I would think his Okidanok, ever-present active principle, I'm not sure. I'd have to really think that out. It's also Blavatsky's concept of the eternal parent space is her concept of the real ether.
Right.
Spelled A-E-T-H-E-R.
Right.
And this seven-skinned eternal parent space, in modern physics, it would be called hyperspace.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a higher dimensional space which underlies the phenomenal world.
And where was that first quote that you read when she was talking about God? That was really interesting. Where did that come from?
That's from the Key to Theosophy.
Oh, Key to Thought Theosophy, yeah.
It's so funny because how it compares with Sagan,
where Sagan says,
people ask me if I believe in God, and I say to them, well, it depends what you mean by God. And Blavatsky says the same thing,
but gives a completely different
answer.
And then Sagan, you know, says it's an either-or. He dichotomizes it. It's either some bearded patriarch who sits around up in a celestial vantage point keeping tabs on creation by counting sparrows and micro-intervening to tell flowers to open, or, and this is the or, the natural laws of the universe. And then he says, I don't know of any compelling evidence to suggest that there exists patriarch, overseeing creation, but would be madness to deny the natural, the existence of natural laws, and, you know, which in itself is such a phony,
simplistic way of conceptualizing
the existence of God. And yet here's Blavatsky saying, no, I don't believe in any kind of bearded patriarch sitting around. Like, yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. What's so amazing about Blavatsky, she's not only saying that the creation is a manifestation of intelligent design, but she's also articulating the principles
right.
of it, of how it's done. She's not just saying God did it, but she's giving us a model of higher dimensions that explains how it actually works.
Right.
Yeah, that's what's so profound about her work, and I don't think has been appreciated. I mean, I can see back 100 years ago, Blavatsky says, everyone will ridicule and dismiss the secret doctrine in this era, but in the century to come, scientists will realize that it hasn't been invented nor exaggerated, but simply outlined.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just reading this book that I was telling about, Christopher Helena Blavatsky, which in the Western Esoteric Masters series, which comes from the North Atlantic Books in Berkeley, California, and a very interesting book edited by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, and it's there's an essay, an overview of her work at the beginning, and then a selection of her writings with commentary, and some of her early writings before she even went to India is very interesting, and a couple of letters that she wrote to these journals which were interested in spiritualism, and she talks about things, and an assurance in the way she says, you know, people are going to reject this, and people are going to say that I'm just making this up, but time will tell. And
there's just
like this confidence there, which is the same like when you read Gurdjieff's speeches in Search of the Miraculous. There's a certainty there which is not arrogance or blowhardedness or any kind of phoniness. It's funny because when I read these things, I can kind of hear it. It's somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, and there's a qualitative difference, I would say, from almost anything else that you read, including people who are, you know, accomplished scholars in science and history. And it's just like these people know what they're talking about, and somehow it comes through.
And also it's amazing, like, when I read The Secret Doctrine now, it's like, wow, it's so illuminating and insightful.
Yeah.
But when I read it 20 years ago, I mean, I still picked up so much, but it was like so beyond me.
Yeah.
It's like you can understand The Secret Doctrine as you progress in your own evolution and awakening. Like, it's not a book you can take in and absorb and understand in mundane mind. You have to kind of develop the higher faculties of your spiritual life to even comprehend it. And then what happens is so interesting is that the ideas become not simply ideas, but they're pointing to something inherent in the structure of reality that you can actually experience aspects of it.
Yeah. And they resonate with meaning and
allow
you to penetrate deeper into things and have a deeper, not only intellectual, but kind of higher emotional understanding of things, eh? Like, it's kind of difficult because we don't have a very good vocabulary for distinguishing different ways of knowing other than intellectually, eh? Like, I mean, that's one thing I find with studying esotericism and mysticism, and it really kind of comes over a series of years, and you have to make a lot of effort, as you say, but you reach a point where somehow things pass from being intellectually known to emotionally known and understood, and it's a much deeper level of understanding and knowledge, I think, that really opens up. Something cracks in a way, and more light comes through somehow, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll move along a bit. We're gonna I'll introduce our first guest in a moment. We have Odin Townley, who's coming on, who's the organizer of the conference in California, and he's gonna come on and we'll talk about the conference and a little bit of the background of the speakers and some of the topics they'll be covering. So we're gonna take about a half hour to do that, And then the second half of the show, we're going to Stephen Levy, who will take about an hour with Stephen, and he's a psychiatrist and a longtime student of theosophy, and he'll share from his perspective. Okay, so Odin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. How you doing? Hello.
Good.
Good.
Yeah, you're okay, a little great. Sound a little bit distant to me, so I'll have to be careful. I'll have to get you to repeat if I can't hear too well,
or maybe is that any better?
Yeah, that is a bit better.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Okay, Odin. Well, we're not too far away, Odin. We're going to be doing the next show. Is going to be live from the conference.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on again. And how you doing, Jim?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really having a great deal of difficulty hearing Odin. Chris, I think mine is even worse than yours. It's like he sounds very distant. I can.
Yeah, he just asked you how you were.
Oh, I'm near and yet I'm distant.
This sounds very existential. You can be in two places at once.
Yeah.
It's like the proverbial atom.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're close to the conference, 2 weeks away, and the next show will be live from the conference with a number of speakers at the conference and questions from the conference. So that will be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Odin, it looks like a very interesting program, and you have quite a diversity of people discussing, like some people more the theosophical movement, talking about that, or the issues of consciousness. My own work on the metaphysics, and it looks like a very interesting program. Plus, you have other things, additional movies, and maybe you could take a few minutes to describe some of the program.
You know, the movies are going to be fun. We're doing one. We're going to discuss crop circles. We're going to show some of them from years ago, and we're also going to talk about the dozens of circles that have dropped in various parts of the world, mainly in England this year. Fantastic formations, and what that means for humanity, and sort of speculate a bit about what they might mean and what they represent for the future, as well as what
it seems,
you know,
like a very active crop circle period.
It is very active right now.
I mean, I've been watching some of the photos you've been sending out, distributing. They're such remarkable formations.
And the perfect geometry.
Yeah.
It's really quite astounding. And what Blavatsky has to say about the hierarchies that are present here with us on Earth, and the various layers of consciousness and planes of substance and being, and you get a real picture from her metaphysics as to what's going on here. And it's very clear that there's a whole other layer of existence, or existences we could say, that are right here with us. This is not a woo-woo thing of UFOs and all of that, but they're not from outer space or from another planet, but actually reside right here with us. As part of our humanity, although for the most part invisible to us. So that is a kind of a shocking interpretation, but we're going to go into that and some questions about that, and then we're going to also see, and just to stay with the movie, we're going to have a movie on a very interesting one that mentions the Theosophical Society in England, and maybe some listeners have heard of it. That's a movie about fairies and how these two young girls were able to see them and nobody else could, and it was just really, it's a fun thing to watch. And it's,
was that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
Yes,
the author of the Sherlock Holmes series.
That's right.
And oh yeah, okay, so he was involved in that. Yeah,
he was involved in that investigation.
Yeah.
So what these ladies are seeing. But as Bruce Lipton says, I think very, very, very well, we are living in exciting times, and that science is in the process of shattering these old myths and rewriting a fundamental belief of human civilization. that we're not controlled by, you know, by a chemical machinery, but there's a level of consciousness and soul freedom and spiritual freedom that is not measurable in the test tubes of modern science. And
yeah, it's a shame. Don't you think, in a way, modern times have so weakened people spiritually through the lack of any meaningful attempt to investigate, like the secret doctrine or other esoteric teachings? Would you agree with that, Odin? Like, it's been almost completely ignored within the educational system.
Well, I think that's probably true. We've all felt a weakening through the materialistic assumptions that have been made about us and about nature, and nothing up to the last few years, at least, was frontier science is now coming into the fore. Have really said anything about our connection with nature? It's now we're in this heated argument between debate between religion, God, and science and religion, and it really ignores the fact that these really are two halves of one whole.
Yeah.
That we need both. We need the mystical and we need the practical aspects of life. And these are planes that we live in every day. We live in the practical and we live in the ideal simultaneously.
Yeah.
And why we have to fight about whether one should dominate, one is true and one isn't, is rather a lot of silliness.
Yeah.
But the investigators are, you know, in these various fields, they're growing in number, such as yourself and many others, Lipton, Laszlo, and I mentioned Lynn McTaggart in the last program we had on her intention experiments.
Yeah.
It just shows that there is just, don't you think, Christopher, there is such a powerful underpinning of consciousness and entanglement that we're all involved in this process together. This is probably the idea that you were saying, is that we've lost that mystical understanding of ourselves and nature and being one entity and being in a process of self-evolution here on the planet. Evolution and deity are not contradictory terms at all.
Sorry, evolution and which?
And deity.
Deity, no. No, Blavatsky talks about evolution. All the way through, about the evolution through all these different planes of existence.
Yes.
Does Blavatsky have a term, like Gurdjieff talks about involution versus evolution? Like, she talks about, like, when the deity becomes a stone through the levels of creation, he would call that involution. And then the reascent, he would call evolution. I wonder if Blavatsky... does she apply evolution both to the kind of involutionary process and the evolutionary, or does she have a similar kind of distinction?
Well, she does refer to the occult hermetic teaching that man becomes a stone, and then a plant, and then an animal, and so forth.
Yeah, worlds through seven, yeah, and then seven animals, and then, yeah, so working its way up through these, and that's evolution.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, in the Secret Doctrine, she says, and there's evolution all the way up till there's reabsorption again in the zero point.
Exactly, but there's no end to this learning process. And
yeah.
Nature and all of its myriad forms are really part of that process right along with us. I mean, you could just look at our bodies and all of the billions of cells and the harmonious way that they're all interconnected and working together to see really a miniature universe going on. And we're just impossible for us to really extract ourselves from the process. We are one with that process, and it is one with us. But her point is that really it's all traditional science is missing and insists on missing because they can't test it, so they say, although there's been plenty of experiments being done to prove that it does exist, which is this underlying consciousness, awareness, sentiency, that life is not just blind matter, but that every cell and every atom even has a consciousness of its own, on its own plane of existence.
Yeah.
I was just reading this newspaper article about this the cat at the nursing home who is able to detect when a person is about to pass away, and it's usually about 4 hours before the time of the person's time, and she will come into the room, quietly slip up onto the bed, and sit lovingly on the person's chest.
Wow.
And about four hours later, almost to the second, the person peacefully passes away. And this has been repeated over and over and over again. So life is sentient, life is aware, and this is, you know, just one small piece of evidence to show that we're all connected, you know, the animal kingdom, mineral kingdom.
One thing that has struck me through my life, like, I almost 30 years ago, I started studying the parapsychology research, and at one point even considered doing some parapsychology research. But I got to the point, I realized, my goodness, there's so overwhelming evidence for ESP, out-of-body experiences, reincarnation, all of these psychical phenomena. There's overwhelming evidence for all of these phenomena.
Sure.
It's just we've never had a way, a model of comprehending how it could all work. And I think that's what's so unique about Blavatsky's work. She not only legitimizes a study of such areas like reincarnation and out-of-body experiences and such, but she provides like a higher dimensional model of how it all hangs together and how it works.
Yeah. We did just don't you see, our standard model is what's holding us back. And unfortunately, it's been that way for centuries. And we develop, through our different specialties, we develop standard models. And it's natural and needful to have standard models. But what problem? It becomes a dogma. So science actually becomes a religion in itself.
Yeah.
Holding on tightly and fiercely to its preconceived ideas.
And kind of closing their eyes to all the enigmas and...
Yeah, unable to comprehend things like, well, a person can communicate over distances with another person, have a conversation on, you know, on the spiritual plane, even with folks who speak to animals, for instance. Some of them may be hoaxed, for sure, but there are many, many real cases where individuals can have conversations with animals and even plants.
Yeah, and it's something that most people know almost intuitively, like
yes,
how psychical their cats are.
Yeah.
I think psychical phenomena happen all the time. It's just people aren't really aware of anything, how anything works.
Well, years ago, a fellow by the name of Cleve Baxter was... A ordinary fellow who was in the business of doing lie detector work, and kind of primitive machinery back in, I think it was the late 60s, when he did his first experiments. But he showed that even plants respond to thought stimuli produced by human beings, as well as to stimuli provided by other kingdoms. And he hooked up his plants to this lie detector and put the electrodes on the leaves and so forth, and he was testing it, and he wanted to see, said, well, it'd be interesting, because he had nothing to do that day, I'll just pour some water and see, just for the heck of it, how long it takes the water to get to the top of the plant. We put a receptor on top of the plant. So he was just, you know, having a break from other things he was doing. And he said, well, gee, I didn't get any reaction on my my oscilloscope with that. He said, "Yeah, I got to figure some other way to get an. I got to get a response out of this plant." So he said, "He thought, well, I'll just go get a match and burn one of the leaves and see what happens." Well, he didn't have to even get out of his chair, because as soon as he had the thought, "I'm going to burn the leaf,"
it responded.
The oscilloscope went off the scale.
Yeah,
and that was the beginning of a decades long quest on his part to see what was going on with this tremendous, interesting phenomena.
By the way, did you hear my cat in the background?
Yeah.
That was my cat. We just finished talking about the cat.
It's funny,
the cat jumped up on my outside window and wanted to come in.
I was going to ask
Her ears were burning. His ears were burning.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, was your cat or one of mine? Because every time I hear a cat meow, I thought maybe the phone was off the hook upstairs or something, and one of the cats is trying to get in on the conversation.
I think his ears are burning. His astral body was burning.
I mean, when you talk about Odin, when you talk about that material at Baxter, the research that he was doing, there was a guy at Yale University in the 30s, I don't know if you know his work, Harold Saxton Burr, who measured what he called L-fields around plants and did quite an extensive amount of research on the idea that what manifests on the physical, externally observable plane is really informed by these life fields that he said would underlie the manifestations of all organic life on Earth. And it's funny, like, I've never really read anybody he did his research in the 30s. I've never really read anything about anybody who's really taken up on his work, because I think, like, he was really on to something, you know, quite profound, and yet it's just sort of...
Body Electric.
Yeah, Becker, I guess, is probably...
And Curly and Photography. And,
but I think Becker, I think, is, you know, I think his work is in that spirit, in a sense, but I think Burr was onto something more of the etheric field, because I don't think really Becker says that. Like, you know, my understanding of what he does. I mean,
I think, as you said, the L field, right? He claimed that was a phenomenon underlying all life, and it can actually be detected by standard voltmeters.
Right.
He proposed a blueprint like mold. For all life, where the voltage measurements themselves were not cast into doubt, but in Burr's interpretation, it failed to gather a lasting impression right then in science, because the science, of course, wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
But this is still a science that's used today in alternative medicine, this force field that surrounds all of us.
Well, again, you know, one thing that always strikes me whenever anybody talks about the materialist perspective and puts forward, you know, the materialist philosophy and says, well, we're just really, you know, we're just molecules, we're just complex arrangements of molecules, and I guess the question that I have for those people, and which it's funny because it doesn't seem to come up that often, but why is it that, how do you explain the fact that essentially all of the molecules in our physical bodies basically turn over? Like, I think it's about 6 months if you and I see one another, and 6 months later we see one another, all the molecules in our face basically are changed. Like, the material, the atoms and molecules that make us up, that manifest as our physical form, they're gone.
Yeah.
Now,
why do we look the same?
You have to account for the persistence of morphology, and also, like, this is what's really interesting to me, is, okay, I cut my arm when I was 12 years old, and I have those scars. Now, obviously, that material is gone, and yet, somehow, the scar persists, and you know, so it's historical. Like, the persistence of the body is in some way historical, but it's not in the matter. There's got to be an intelligence which not only informs the body but somehow remembers everything that happens to it. Now, that to me seems to be like the major problem with the whole materialist position in medicine and in biology, is like, how do you explain that? Is there something I'm missing here and it's not in the chromosome? Because Larry Dossey addresses this. He says, not in your DNA, because those molecules change too. So, you know, like, what is it that I'm missing here?
Yeah, there has to be like an underlying templates
right.
or fields which have an organizing influence. It's just like, how do different cells in different parts of the body know how to differentiate?
Yeah, exactly.
And there has to be an underlying field. Like, this is like Sheldrake's work on morphogenic fields.
Yeah,
right.
You can't explain the growth of biological organisms. You can't explain it mechanistically.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is Bruce Lipton's crusade, is to show how these receptors, actually their antennae on each of the cells, is the way that they is their point of contact with that field that connects all the cells together. This is why billions of cells in the human body really all know what each other are doing, although not on that conscious level that we understand. So if we expand that to this idea that you mentioned, Jim, about how why is it that the morphic field persists, and we look the same pretty much all day, people can continue to recognize us, while at the same time it's said that Blavatsky, the seven-year cycle where all of these components, physical components, the cells and the atoms, leave and are replaced by new ones. But now it's reduced, I think, down to 7 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
So every 7 weeks or so, we have completely new atomic and cellular structure. All the old cells have died away and new have been replaced by new ones.
Yeah. Wow.
So the mystery has to be solved somewhere else than in the physical organism. It has to be seen, as you said, this morphogenetic field that Sheldrake discovered years and years ago.
Yeah.
Proposed. And that morphic field is it's not just energy, blank energy. It's also information patterns.
Yeah, information. I think that's so important. Like that, in the new physics, they're recognizing information as third force that
exactly.
guides the manifestations of matter and energy. So there's underlying information fields that permeate space. Like,
well, this morphic resonance is also not only information, but it also carries the kinds of information it carries are not just patterns. Which structures have, like an architect's blueprint, which is what the astral body basically is a blueprint or a model. But it also carries information about our emotions, about our intentions, about our memories, even about our past lives.
Yeah.
So in a sense, we're a universe, completely unique and total, and we contain everything that we've ever been and ever will be. And that's another hard one.
Yeah.
How the future can precede us. How can we know the future? Is because it's right around us, based on patterns that we've already set up. But these archetypes were spoken of by even Carl Jung. We talked about the collective unconscious. And he had a sense that field must be there. So it's a mind, there's a universal mind that Blavatsky presents. And this universal mind is an informational containing energy field that embellishes the whole universe itself.
Yeah, I love the quote from Blavatsky. At one point, she says that there is one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So it's like what she's saying is there's this information of the whole present everywhere.
Yep.
And we live within that field and are differentiated out of that field, but ultimately we resolve back into it.
Right.
Odin, I noticed we're coming to quarter to the hour,
and
Stephen is likely waiting for his call. So we'll have you back in about an hour, Odin. Because I think, can we get you back and we'll just give out some final information about the conference? And or do you want to finish up now?
Yeah,
and then
I'll give you just a quick thumbnail on the conference. Then I got to get off to a meeting later. So
we're gonna
have a lady from the San Diego University in the Anthropology Archaeology Department. And she's going to talk about 21st century social movements and ideologies. And then Steve Levy is going to present a very fascinating explanation of the new psychology and how Blavatsky has the solutions for many of the enigmas of our psychological systems. And then Helena Kirikazi, who's a biotechnician, she's going to talk about, and she's a PhD candidate for neuropsychology, and she has a new phrase, neuromodulation, which is a new science of shifting consciousness, she says, and deal with this one-sided mode of dealing with the problem that Blavatsky says is due largely to the Western practice of subordinating consciousness to the byproduct of molecular motion, as she says. Mm-hmm. So she's going to talk about behavior and how this is not byproducts of molecules, but rather there's a powerful wave that is sweeping cellular medicine now, which shows that there is this underlying consciousness that affects our health and everything, our entire life, really. And then Eva Moberg from Sweden, she's a practitioner and the Bach Flower Remedies. She's going to talk about that and the various complementary medicine and tying that into Blavatsky's teaching as well. Blavatsky was ubiquitous. She covered every possible field of human endeavor. Then, of course, we're going to have hopefully that zero-point live radio show if we can get the technicalities put together.
Okay.
And Judy Salfman from Cal Poly is going to talk about God and science and all the new literalists on both sides and how they're these raging topics of debate are going back and forth and, you know, what theosophy, how theosophy fits in with that. And, of course, we're looking forward to your presentation on God, science, and the sacred doctrine. And the last, I think, David Ruff is a professor from the Netherlands, the University of Maastricht, and he teaches criminal law and philosophy, which is an interesting take on what the possibilities are in that field. And he's going to discuss the question of what really is, what defines science.
Yeah.
And he's going to go into what a pseudoscience is and what the relationships are between the ancient science, modern science, pseudoscience, occult science, and try to put the whole package together for us so we better understand it. So looking forward to a great conference and come back with some new vistas on who we are as humanity and what we can practically do to improve our lot here.
Yeah, it's going to be such an interesting conference, and it runs 2.5 days there from Friday evening to Sunday at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners, you want to see the program, you can go to www.theosophysandiego.org. Or you could go to www.blavatsky.net.
Right.
And the schedule and information's up there. And do you have a number, Odin, that anybody can call you if they have any questions or call about the conference? Or
sure. Jim and Sally Colbert in San Diego are giving out information and taking reservations. And they're at theosophysandiego.org. And their phone number there is 760, area code 760. 765-1090.
Great.
And they'll be able to help you with any of the details if you want to get over there to the conference in Petaluma. That's Northern California. And by the way, it's being held at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is an interesting campus in and of itself. And we're going to enjoy looking around there. And that's in Petaluma, California.
Great.
No, I know that the president emeritus, Willis Harmon, of IONS, one of the early founders, or connected with the founder, said that they acknowledged that Blavatsky was an integral part of their own origins, he said.
Wow.
So we're excited to be there.
Yeah.
Feel like we're coming home.
Yeah. Well, I think Blavatsky's work is just going to become more and more widely known. It's like we've never tapped the treasury of her work and the breadth of her knowledge.
No.
If she was just too far ahead. But I think with the new concepts emerging in medicine and science and all the enigmas, it's forcing us to kind of think more deeply about the kinds of issues that Madame addressed.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much going to change our vision of reality, which is one of the things I noticed about, I said about the conference, but it's more going to be really confirm the inner vision of reality that each of us has as human beings, that as Jim said, has been, you know, has been stifled and been sleeping for so long.
Yeah.
HBB did notice that the sleeping giant is awakening. That was back in the 1800s. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had a soulless psychology for a century,
exactly.
And they've eliminated spirit from nature for a century. So,
and
yeah,
Darwin did a great job on that, but not Darwin so much as the neo-Darwinists. They're taking over every field.
Mm-hmm.
It's materialistic evolution by random mutations is now in psychology and biology and astronomy, everywhere you go.
Yeah, all of which serves to dehumanize human beings and regard us simply as like higher primates and material beings.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, you know, in doing the research that I've been doing for the book I'm writing right now on the problem of God's contracting universe, because about your work and you know, the history of the last 30 years in terms of your development, your model. There's such incredible, there's so many good books out there in which really that whole perspective is just shown to be what it is, how limited it is and how it's based on all sorts of assumptions that aren't based on any kind of evidence, but are just, you know, ideologically driven, and it's quite extraordinary in a way that there's not more debate about these things. That you know, I think there's a huge underground movement of people who put forth, you know, a really coherent alternative ideas. But the problem is, it doesn't seem to affect the mainstream. It's like everything kind of rolls along barely on its way, and it doesn't really change in a sense. It's very peculiar.
Yeah. Yeah, it's those people are marginalized.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I heard Dean Radin on Coast to Coast saying, you know, how much trouble, like in the whole free world, there's only a few places where you can study paranormal phenomena, and yet it's the most essential area of study to the whole investigation of the nature of man.
Yeah.
You know, but they're marginalized. And at the same time, I mean, I believe that there are elements in our society who have studied these subjects very extensively, but have hidden that knowledge from us.
Yeah.
And in a way, they wanted to dummy down the public educational system, while they themselves have developed in their understandings of these other areas.
Yeah. Well, it's like the crop circles. I mean, there they are every year.
Yeah.
They plop down in the fields in a few minutes overnight, and fantastic designs that, and no footsteps leading to them or away from them. No money footprints. Obviously put there by some unknown agency. And this has been going on for, what, 20, 30 years that we can document them, and not a peep out of science. The only thing was, I think it was a story that was in the UK in Mail, the newspaper in Mail, a couple of weeks ago, mentioned one of the most fantastic circles that have come up this year, and of course couldn't go unnoticed. So I managed to make them a mainstream news media for once.
Oh.
But otherwise, for science goes, as you said, it's marginalized and just sniffed at, waiting for proof when I've been supplied. It's already been there. But that's how progress occurs. And she was it Montaigne or something? I forget who she quotes. When she said, but what we accept as ordinary today was at once considered outlandish and outrageous, and it just takes a lot of time before, you know, the minds of the whole of humanity finally come to the point where they recognize something that was there all along.
Yeah, it's funny, and at the same time, I think that people intuitively know in their hearts that there's more to reality than meets the eye.
Absolutely.
And you see that in surveys, like you do a Gallup poll, like 87% believe in the existence of God or some other higher reality. So people, in my view, know in their hearts this, but the mind longs to know the secrets of the heart. And so it's bridging that gap between what we intuitively feel about existence versus what science is trying to persuade us is a material basis for life.
Yeah, well, those in citadels of power, whether it be political, science, religion, or anything else, it's in their best interest to control information. So that's what they do. As you said, that information, that the real information is going to persist in human consciousness and spirit. It's not going to go away.
Yeah.
It's going to be heard.
Okay, so, well, that's going to be very exciting, Odin. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
You got it.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Have a great day,
thanks,
guys.
Thanks, Odin. Have a good conference.
Hey, thank you, Jim. Take care.
Yes. Goodbye.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, so I just mentioned to Don there, or Doug in the background of BBS, and maybe they'll get our next guest on. Our next guest is Stephen Levy, and Stephen's a psychiatrist in the States and a longtime student of theosophy, and he'll be presenting at the conference. And we'll just wait. He'll probably, if you come on, Stephen, and hear us, please let us know you're there, and otherwise... any comments, Jim?
well, yeah. As I told you the other day when we were talking, I've been rereading Where the Wasteland Ends by Theodore Roszak, and boy, that is, for all our listeners, I highly recommend that book. I read it probably 20 years ago, but rereading it, what a wealth of information.
Yeah.
I think maybe our guest is coming on.
Stephen Levy? Stephen, are you there?
Right here.
Oh, yeah. Welcome, Stephen. I introduced you a moment ago, so we've been waiting. Sorry we're a little bit late. We took more time with Odin, but we can keep you till the end of the show here.
That's fine.
So if we have 45 minutes or so. Anyway. Welcome. You're going to be at the conference. We've been talking about that. Your background's in psychiatry. Have you studied Blavatsky's work for many years, Stephen?
Yes, yeah, so I've been a student of her works for a number of years, just about as long as I've been a doctor. So we've had quite a bit of experience with it.
Could you share something of what you'll be exploring at the conference in your talk? Not to ask you to give your talk now, but...
Well, actually, what we're going to be looking at is the movement towards a psychology for the 21st century, and what we're going to be examining is that there have been many discoveries among neuroscientists and psychologists towards the latter part of the 20th century and as we move into the 21st century that are really a challenge for the conventional theoretical models of psychology and seem to require a new format in which to explain them, as well as a phenomenon that we recognize in psychiatry that don't seem to have any clear explanation from our conventional theories. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be looking at that and how theosophy also contributes to that understanding.
Yeah, it's like more and more this issue of the nature of human consciousness has become the central enigma, I would say, in modern psychology and science. It's like we've made no progress really in understanding that most basic phenomena of the inner experience of being, that inner consciousness of self.
Well, it's actually interesting because in the areas we would call the noetic scientists, noetic sciences, those that study various psi phenomenon and extreme psychophysiological phenomenon, memory, near-death experiences and so forth, What they have concluded is that consciousness is a fundamental aspect of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness and mind influence matter. Mind can function independently of the brain. And there are different planes and states of consciousness beyond our normal awareness. And, of course, these ideas, as we see them discovered by modern science, have been repeated over and over again